This is Life Rattle. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1170, we present the third of a four-show series of outstanding writing, Life Rattle Classics, written and read by Natalia Segal. Natalia Segal was born in Moscow in 1974. In 1982, Segal came, with her mother, to Winnipeg, where her father had settled 5 years earlier. The family moved to Toronto in 1983. Segal left the family home soon after and moved around the country during the next 10 years, living in BC, Nova Scotia, Alberta, as well as Ontario. She lived on the streets, in rooming houses, deep in the woods on mountains and on the sand and hidden beaches, in a small trailer on Cape Breton Island, and in abandoned buildings, squats. Sometimes she held down an apartment for a few months, but mostly she wandered. Segal hitchhiked up and down Canada, entertained tired truckers with stories, and babysat children in winter in exchange for a spot to sleep on their parents' floor. She panhandled, begged, and read fortunes, tarot cards and palms for a living. She ate at Salvation Armies or any other soup kitchens and food vans she found. She trained dogs, chalked on cement, and painted faces on rocks and glued pennies together. Segal eventually got off the street, slowed down, completed her MFA in creative writing, and met Sandra, who became her wife yesterday, September 17th. Natalia Segal now lives and writes in Toronto with Sandra and their two daughters, Alma and Zara. Segal has written a collection of stories about her life on the streets, sparse, hard-hitting prose that doesn't compromise or apologize for itself. Let's listen now to George, tonight's first story, written and read by Natalia Segal, which will be immediately followed by Are You Sitting Down? And Pastificios. The stories on tonight's program are not for the young or for the faint-hearted. Listener's discretion is strongly advised.
George by Natasha Sigalov. Alma brought her sister, Ursula, to the party at the Willard Hall squat, 20 Gerrard Street East. Ursula was a cheerful young girl. She said she was 16, but nobody believed her. Ursula wore pink fuzzy sweater and hip-hugger Levi's jeans. A thin gold necklace dangled from Ursula's thick white neck. A delicate pendant held onto the necklace, a pendant shaped into the letter U. "Party?" Ursula squealed with a smile and clapped her hands together. "I like parties." At the party, Ursula ingested pot and acid and shrooms and beer and wine and vodka. Later, she disappeared with six guys. The next morning, Ursula talked a little slower. She opened and closed her eyes in a strange, childlike way, as if she didn't believe or understand what she was looking at. "She's still stoned from the night before," I thought. Ursula talked slow and clenched and unclenched her palms and rubbed her eyes with her knuckles and stared at people too closely for the rest of the week. Alma hit and kicked and tore at her sister's hair. "Stop this fucking bullshit! Stop it! It's not funny anymore!" Alma screamed at Ursula. Ursula talked slow and clenched and unclenched her palms and rubbed her eyes with her knuckles and stared at people too closely for the rest of the month. Alma disappeared. We got used to Ursula and called her George. "I'll love him and squeeze him and hug him and call him George, duh." Ursula smiled an imbecile smile at her new name. Are You Sitting Down? By Natasha Sigalov. Half pint. Phone for you. I sit at the small, round, green wood and metal fold-out tables inside Evergreen. Evergreen, 381 Young Street, is a Christian drop-in center for street youth. Half pint. Phone. Pastor Mike's voice jingles through the air like church bell choirs. Phone for you, half pint. Pastor Mike yells. I stand, push my plastic red chair with the back of my knees, scratch the scabies-infested crook of my arm, and stagger towards Evergreen's small black home phone. Thanks. I slide the phone off Pastor Mike's open palm. Speak, I say. Half pint? It is I. Half pint, it's Jen. Hi, Jen. Half pint, are you sitting down? No, I'm standing. Please go get a chair and sit down. Fuck you, what the fuck? Please get a chair, half pint. Jen's voice drips patience. I drop the phone on the counter, bang. Stomp to the closest red plastic chair and drag it back to the counter, screech. Screech. I lift the heavy black receiver. Okay, I'm sitting down. I fall, schlump, into the hard red molded plastic. Half pint. Jen sucks her teeth and clears her throat. What the fuck is going on, Jen? Half pint. Gluebag Dave is dead. Yeah. Very funny. Fuck you very much. Ha ha. I tap my index finger against the receiver. No, half pint. This is real. Dave is dead. They found him this morning. Someone killed him. I stand, rest my elbows on the warm black counter, and press the edge of the muffin crumb scattered countertop into my stomach. It was that bastard Clint and his bullshit skinhead cronies. The police don't know who did it, Jen says. I don't give a shit what the pigs don't know. I slam the phone into its cradle. Bang. Bang, bang. Pastificios by Natasha Sigalov. Pastificios, Bar and Grill, Yonge Street, Toronto, Ontario, midnight. Skids line the entrance to the bar. Skids line the walls like empty Molson cases. Skids lean against brown rickety wood tables. Skids slump against four cedar booths and scratch scabies off their arms and stomachs, and lean their heads on dirty wooden tables. We drink. We drink like desert plants drink dew off stingy morning sunrays. Beer spills. Dave drips off everybody's lips. Big Sue cries. I sit alone inside a dark booth by the door and sip my Molson 50. A small pile of green, peeled 50 labels rests beside my arm. Half pint. Chelsea veers her head into my little booth. Chelsea is a willowy girl with a Chelsea haircut. Bald all over, with long bangs and curly tufts of hair veiling her ears. Chelsea is Daryl's girlfriend. Daryl is a skinhead. Hi, I say, grit my teeth, and tap an index finger against my brown Molson 50 beer bottle. "Can I sit with you for a minute?" Chelsea smiles an uneasy smile and buries one of her Doc Martens boots with the other. "Sit." I lift my beer, press the brown bottle between my teeth, tilt and gulp, and slam the bottle against the dark brown wood table before me. I squint my eyes at Chelsea. Chelsea slinks onto the bench across from me and looks around nervously. "Half pint. I know who killed Dave," Chelsea whispers. "This look like the fucking cop shop to you?" I stare into Chelsea's watery green eyes. She's only been on the streets for a month and contemplates smashing my beer bottle against her smooth white forehead and jabbing it between her thin, frail ribs. "How dare you come in here and expect a friend, you stupid skinhead wannabe weekend warrior whore? We all know who your fucking skinhead boyfriend killed, Dave. You useless fucking slut. If I took you right now, the whole crew would join in. We'd send our messages to Dave with you, you fucking bitch." "Daryl and Clint killed Dave," Chelsea whispers. I glare at Chelsea's small round face. "I know," I grind my teeth. "We all fucking know who killed Dave." "Daryl came home last night. He was covered in blood. He told me how it happened. What he did." I nod, lean my chest against the wooden table between us, grab her eyes with mine, and nod again. "He said," Chelsea flicks a pack of Export A green cigarettes open, yanks the tinfoil cover off the second deck of smokes, crushes it between her long white Nazi fingers, and stuffs the tinfoil ball into the empty half of the green cigarette package. Her hand shakes. "Daryl and Clint were drinking all night at Gary's place. Dave was asleep on the couch. Daryl said that he and Clint woke Dave up and said, 'Wake up, buddy boy. Today's your dying day.' Daryl said that they took Dave to the bathtub and stabbed him in the chest, and that no matter how many times they stabbed him, he just refused to die. And he screamed and begged for his life." Chelsea chokes and coughs and wipes her eyes and continues. "Daryl said that Dave screamed so much, they took Dave's ID and stuffed it between his top and bottom front teeth and kicked his mouth shut. Daryl said they broke the knife inside Dave's chest and he still wouldn't die. Then Daryl told me that they didn't have another sharp knife, so they tried to cut Dave's head off with one of those serrated bread knives." Chelsea glances around the side of our table. I lean back against the worn, warm wood and watch the woolly wee girl. "I called the police," Chelsea says. "I called the police right after Daryl left and told them everything." Chelsea wipes the table with a nervous hand. "Did you call anonymously?" I ask. "No. I told them my name and who I am, and I went down to the station and wrote a statement and signed it." My heart tip-taps against my throat. Poor stupid fucking kid. "Does anyone else know you called the police?" "No." "Have you told anyone else at all that you called the cops?" I lean across the tepid table. "I had to call the cops. They killed an innocent person." Chelsea wipes her green eyes and rests her forehead against her elbows and propped palm. "Listen, no one will care what happened. A rat is a rat." I push my beer aside, reach my right hand across the beer-soaked table surface and squeeze the edge of Chelsea's side of the table. "But they killed him," Chelsea whimpers into her palm and glares up into my eyes. If word gets out you called the cops, you're dead. They killed him. We will kill you too. Chelsea's eyes move across my lips and tremble. Do you think anybody heard what I said to you? Chelsea sinks into the table. Pick up your bag and go, and don't come back. Chelsea wipes her bag off the floor, drops her head, and scuttles out the door.
That was Natalia Segal reading her stories, George, Are You Sitting Down?, and Pastor Physios. Now let's listen to tonight's fourth, fifth, and sixth stories. Grange Park, followed immediately by Doing It, and Children, all written and read by Natalia Segal. These stories are not for the young or for the faint of heart. Listener's discretion is strongly advised.
Grange Park by Natasha Sigalov. Grange Park stands nestled behind the Art Gallery of Ontario on Dundas Street West. Grange Park has outside washrooms with a long concrete roof in front of them to shelter people from the rain. On a cold November morning, I wake up in Grange Park beside the ladies' washroom, beneath the long concrete roof. I roll over. I'm drenched in hot, wet sweat. I groan and lift my face and listen to the frost on my sleeping bag crackle. Last night my left ear hurt so much I cried and cried and cried. This morning the pain is worse. This morning I can't hear through my left ear at all. You getting up today, half pint? Sean leans over me. I'm dying, I answer. Well, Sean spreads his orange sleeping bag on top of my green sleeping bag and on top of me. Steve took your dog's panning with him already, and I'm going over there now to take over for him. We'll feed the dogs for you, too. Sean says, layers Steve's green sleeping bag on top of his sleeping bag and mine. I moan a pitiful moan, roll to my side, and watch 100 Chinese people perform their morning Tai Chi exercises on the frost-kissed orange grass. You gotta go to the doctor, half pint, Sean says, kneels on one knee, and laces his brown running shoes. I went to the walk-in clinic beside Eaton Center yesterday. They said they won't take me without a health card, I say. Bastards. I hack green phlegm. Green phlegm oozes down my cheek. I close my eyes. I'm dying. I shiver, sob, and spasm inside my sleeping bag. I drift to sleep. Half pint. Half pint. Steve kicks me awake. Where are my dogs? I struggle with my eyes. My eyes are glued shut with pus. I can barely hear Steve's booming voice. Dogs are with Sean, half pint. Dogs are fine. Steve hands me a warm, round styrofoam container. You hungry? I got you some soup, Steve says. I push myself up. Thanks, Steve. Steady myself with one arm and take the soup from Steve's outstretched hand. The pain jabs through my ear like a hypodermic needle. I sip my soup and choke back sobs. I crawl from beneath the mound of sleeping bags and blankets. Atta girl, Steve smiles. I stagger to the toilet and puke from the pain. When I return from the toilet, Steve is gone. I roll up the sleeping bags and fold the torn wool blankets and pile the heap against the bathroom wall. I tie my hair back with a shoelace. I wobble and weave to a walk-in clinic on Young Street at college. I step into the front office and hurl myself at the front desk. I grip the desk with both hands. My teeth clatter against one another. I feel hot and cold, and hot and cold, and fucking hot and bloody fucking cold. I am in a great deal of pain. I have no health card. I must see the doctor, I say. We need a health card, the receptionist says. Tears, large as marbles, roll down my face, cascade off my quivering lips, and splash onto my feet. I'm in pain, I say. The receptionist strolls from the desk and disappears behind an office door. I lean on the desk and cough wet abrasive coughs into my fist. My lips are red like ripe tomatoes and dry and chapped and cracked like old sidewalks in the sun. It hurts to speak. The receptionist emerges from the door. Take a seat, she says. The doctor will be with you shortly. Inside the doctor's office, a thin blonde nurse stands beside me. The doctor, a middle-aged man with thick dark hair and a white jacket, peers into my ear with a triangular flashlight. I grit my teeth against the agony. She has an ear infection, the doctor tells the nurse, and presses a cold metal disc against my back. Sounds like fluid in her lungs, probably pneumonia, the doctor says, and scampers from the room. I turn and gaze at the nurse. I can't hear, I say. Will I get my hearing back? I don't know, the nurse answers. The doctor ambles into the room, kneels in front of me, and hands me a yellow bottle of pills. Take one pill, 3 times a day, on a full stomach, until the pills are gone, the doctor tells me. A full stomach? I take the pills and clench them in my fist. Thank you. Back in my sleeping bag at Grange Park, I swallow my third pill with a bite of half a tuna sandwich from the Anishinaabe food patrol van. I watch the sun set over the treetops and flip my dollar store diary open. Dear Diary, today marks the 6th year of my time on the street. Everyone I knew when I first came here is dead or dying or in jail. No matter how hard I try to get off the street, get a job, get a home, get a life, I always end up coming back here. I watch the old bag lady with the baby stroller that she pushes and the little doll inside that she thinks is a real baby, and I believed I would be her someday. Today, I do not think I'll make it that far. Today I watch the people walk their dogs inside this park, and I wish I could be them. How do they fucking do it? How do they live and eat and hold down jobs and have a place of their own? Do they ever look at me and think they may be in my spot one day? No home, no bed to sleep in, no fridge full of food to wake up to. Lately, when I sleep at night, I dream of a warm home and a fridge full of food. I always thought that I was only here for a short while. I thought that by the time I hit 16, I would get welfare and a place to live, then a job and a life and food on the table. But here I am, 19 years old, still on the street. One by one, by one, by one, by one, all my friends are dead. I look around and wonder who'll die next. Today I know who will die next. I will. If I don't give it my best try, if I don't give it one more fucking try right fucking now, I've been here long enough to know, I will be dead before next summer hits. It's my turn. I guess it's no longer a matter of, am I ready to try again? Now it's a matter of, am I ready to die? I am not. I am not. I shut my diary and tuck it in my backpack. My backpack doubles as a pillow. And lay my head on top and close my eyes. Doing It by Natasha Sigalov. I felt tired a lot, so I went to the doctor and I got a pregnancy test and an AIDS test. The pregnancy test came back negative. The AIDS test came back positive, Jesse says. Shaggy knew Jesse had AIDS, but he fucked her anyway. Shaggy did it for love. Peter asked Jesse how she got all that money, $900 a month, from welfare. Jesse told Peter she was on FBA because she had AIDS. Peter told Jesse he wanted to get AIDS, so he can get all that money every month, too. Peter did it for money. Dash knew Jesse had AIDS. Dash didn't fuck her. Dash ripped out all her insides. Dash's hands were covered with open wounds. Jesse's blood covered his hands. Dash did it for Satan. Dice knew Jesse had AIDS, but he fucked her without a condom anyway. Dice didn't know why he did it. Children by Natasha Sigalov. Jesse had four children. She gave her first son, Alan, for adoption when he was two. Jesse's second son, John, she named him Jonathan Lee Hayes because she thought it would look good on a business card. Lives in and out of children's aid care. Jesse's third son, Daniel, was Shaggy's son too. Daniel went up for adoption when he was 6 months old. Shaggy died of AIDS. Jesse's daughter, Margaret, was born HIV positive and given up for adoption to an adoption agency called Diamonds for Jesus. A pediatric doctor adopted Margaret and treated her immediately with the HIV cocktail. Margaret is HIV negative now. Punky French didn't speak any English. She was a tall, thin girl with scraggly, limp, blue and purple mohawk. Punky French slept in the park beside me. Her thin baby, Jean Baptiste, lay on her beer-soaked chest and cried and cried and cried, the pitifulest of cries. all night. Crystal's oldest son, Davy, was a fat and chubby little boy, fast and chubby little boy. Crystal left Davy's father, Dave Sr., with Davy, and hung out in Peter's, an underground bar on Yonge and College. Crystal left Dave Sr. for Conan when she saw how well Conan played pool. She took Davy with her. Crystal and Conan had two more boys, Roger and Danny. Now there were three boys. Danny, 4 months old, spent his time in a small crib beside the TV, with a bottle of sugar water between his weak lips and a veil of green cigarette and brown pot smoke around him. Danny and Roger lived in their room. One afternoon, Roger broke his room's window and climbed outside. Crystal found Roger outside, kicking and hitting and smashing a poplar tree by the door. Dorothy had five children, each child to his own father, in a two-bedroom apartment. All of Dorothy's kids were boys. Dorothy said she wasn't stopping till she got a girl. Care Bear had a boy. She named him John. Care Bear left John with his father for 2 years, then took John back. Now John lives in a foster home in Alberta. Natasha named her baby girl Alexis. Natasha couldn't pass the heroin drug tests, and Children's Aid put Alexis up for adoption. I saw Natasha lying in the street last year. She didn't look well. Jenny had a baby girl with Mike. They named her Cherry. Jenny beat Mike with a baseball bat. Mike gave Jenny a black eye. I don't know what happened to Cherry. Lisa had an abortion. Shih Tzu had three abortions. Chris can't remember how many abortions she's had. Over 10. Braindead and Lynn had 9 children between them. Some children together, some with different parents, all in Children's Aid care now. Frankie, 5'9", 250 pounds, had 2 girls. She named the first girl Rain. I saw Frankie panhandling in front of the Evergreen last summer. She says sometimes she loses it with her kids and hits them so hard. Danielle had Safira. Safira went to live with Danielle's grandmother in British Columbia when Danielle went back to speed and coke and crack and whoring on Ottawa streets. Danielle had Kyle. Kyle went to live with Janice, Danielle's friend, when Danielle hit him on the head too hard, too many times. Danielle says she doesn't do drugs anymore. I'm clean. I only do speed, acid, and pot now. Got a smoke? Danielle says. Danielle is pregnant again.
That was Natalia Segal reading her stories, Grange Park, Doing It, and Children. That concludes Life Rattle number 1170. Arnie Achtman recorded Natalia Segal reading her stories. My name is Laurie Callis. Life Rattle returns next Sunday night at 9 o'clock with more stories by Natalia Segal. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Achtman.